This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. This hour, why the new abortion law in Texas has so far managed to avoid being blocked by the courts. Also, the calendar may say you're 48, but what does your body say? And the huge problem of bovine tuberculosis in the UK, and why an alpaca named Geronimo is at the center of it. That's coming up on Top of Mind. It's good to have you with us. Many states have attempted to pass an abortion ban as strict as the one Texas just enacted. And usually those laws are struck down by the courts before they even take effect. But the Texas law is written in a way that has made it difficult to challenge in court. Even the U.S. Supreme Court opted not to intervene and block the law. Let's talk about why this law in Texas has opened a new frontier in the abortion debate. I'm joined on the line by legal scholar Leslie Francis. She's a professor in the University of Utah's Law School and Philosophy Department, and she joins me now. Professor Francis, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much for having me, Julie.
What does this law in Texas ban?
So the first thing to be aware of is that it is a prohibition that works through a civil suit against either someone who performs or aids and abets performance. And an abortion is defined as ending a pregnancy once a heartbeat has been detected or without doing the most appropriate medical test to detect a heartbeat. That's in effect after about 6 weeks from the woman's last menstrual period. Now, there is one exception. It's for an abortion performed to save the woman's life. So serious threats to the mother's health don't count. Fetal anomalies that are inconsistent with life don't count. Rape and incest don't count. So it's about as stringent an abortion statute, probably one that's more stringent than many abortion opponents would like to see. A 13-year-old incest victim will have to carry a pregnancy to term in Texas, even if it threatens lifelong disability for her.
Unless she can get into the doctor within 6 weeks of her period.
Within 6 weeks of her last menstrual period, which is, in effect, a two-week late period.
What would normally happen? Kind of walk me through what would be the normal process when a state passes a law that is more strict than Roe versus Wade, which established the right to abortion at a certain period in a woman's pregnancy.
So the way it would end up being quite quickly blocked by the court is the law would either create a regulatory requirement that is imposed by the state or would criminalize some conduct that is involves the state as an actor. What this statute does explicitly is say that there is to be no enforcement by the state. The only remedy is that anyone in the world, whether they have any connection with Texas, whether they live in the United States, or whether they have any connection with the people at issue in the case, anyone can sue someone who performs or aids or abets an abortion. So it's privately enforced. It's what some people are referring to as vigilante justice.
Mm. Right. Some of the critics in particular of this law.
Of the law, yeah.
The way things have normally happened where these laws have been struck down, it's because an abortion access group can sue the state of Texas or sue the state of whatever that had passed this. And so there's clearly somebody who's responsible for enforcing this thing that they can say is unconstitutional based on Supreme Court rulings. And there's like a clear way to get to court to challenge it. But but that has not been the case in here because you can't sue the state of Texas because it's not the state of Texas enforcing it. It's just sort of anyone who decides to sue.
Well, that's what the hope was of the drafters of the statute. Now, one of the things that is true is suppose somebody decides to sue, there is going to be the state in the picture in the form of the state courts, because where you sue is you go to court. And so one of the questions that is being discussed is whether it was appropriate for the court to simply say, this is not a case for us because the state isn't involved.
Right, right. So and when you're talking about the court, it's the court, capital C, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, which did weigh in. So let's talk through that. So as this law was, first of all, as you mentioned, which is an important point, this law was very specifically drafted to try to make it hard for abortion rights and abortion access groups to be able to block it in court. One of the challenges they had was figuring out who to sue if it's not, if they can't sue the enforcer because lawsuits haven't been brought and the state isn't enforcing it, right? So one of the things they did was they tried to sue like Texas judges or the kind of en masse. Is that right? And what?
Well, they tried to get injunctive relief against the statute. And one of the theories is that, yeah, the state is involved. It's just indirect. And the question is whether, is that enough? Should have been argued out, but it wasn't because of the way the court, the Supreme Court treated the case. I think it's really important, Julie, for your listeners to understand first what a very strange enforcement scheme this is. So I'll just give you another example, and I don't know how your listeners would feel about it, but just imagine we had a state that was very concerned about guns. And it wanted to make it much more difficult for people to own guns. But instead of restricting gun ownership or having anything to do with background checks or anything like that on the part of the state, what the statute said was that any individual who is injured has a right to bring suit against a gun owner. And it kept the state completely out of it. And there was no way to challenge that.
So even though the Supreme Court and the Constitution say there's a right to have a gun, a state could pass a law that says guns are not allowed, but leave it up to the people to enforce that. And so I would have to sue my neighbor for having a gun if I could prove that somehow that endangers me or harms me.
Or made me afraid for my children or something like that. And the reason I bring that up is that I think the issue for your listeners to think about isn't really, I mean, about the Texas law, isn't what are your views about abortion? But what are your views about creating this scheme of private enforcement? And so I'm not saying that a state could do that, but I'm just saying let's turn the tables and pick a cause that many people would have different views about.
Is this not a framework that's used to enforce other laws or priorities in the country?
Well, We don't usually create a bounty system, a minimum of $10,000, whether you're hurt at all.
This is a piece that's written into the Texas law, kind of as a motivation, or it's the reason why any random person might want to try to sue a doctor who performs an abortion after the fetal heartbeat is detectable. So what is that incentive built into the law?
The incentive is a minimum of $10,000 that you get as a private enforcer.
So I could have somehow, if I have evidence that I can bring that indicates that someone either performed or assisted in some way, aided or abetted by driving the woman to the clinic or, you know, the person who performed the abortion, if I can prove that it happened, then the doctor or whoever I sued has to pay me $10,000 and cover my legal fees.
Right.
Interesting.
And the doctor, suppose I cook this up in a very flimsy way. So, you know, I just kind of think this person is doing it and I heard a rumor and I go to court. Well, the doctor can't just let it go. The doctor's going to have to do something at least to answer to get it thrown out. And so even if I bring a frivolous suit, the doctor, by the statute, cannot get his or her attorney fees. So it also creates a serious imbalance about attorney's fees.
Okay. So this isn't a situation where they're alleging that this doctor committed a crime. It's that a civil lawsuit, the distinction there is that you're trying to win damages rather than put somebody in jail.
Right. And something that's also unusual here is, usually you have to prove that you've been harmed. I mean, I actually built that into the gun hypothetical a minute ago. So you have to prove that you suffered some damages. That would be standard in tort law, not that something happened. But here it's what you would have to show is that the doctor or the aider or the abettor met the statutory conditions, and then you win $10,000 or more. The statute is silent as to how much more and why.
So for all of those reasons, then, for the financial incentive, the way that it's slanted in favor of the person who's bringing the lawsuit against the abortion provider or abettor, and the fact that the individual doesn't have to prove that they were harmed in some way by this, by the individual, all of that makes this an unusual way to enforce a policy.
And the reason I gave you a sort of different case to think about is that creating this kind of private citizen snitch thing is a recipe for, I mean, wherever we want to do it, it's a recipe for creating dissension among neighbors. I mean, just imagine if you were afraid your neighbor were going to go to court on something like this.
Yeah.
I mean, it smacks of Nazi Germany or the Stasi in East Germany.
Now, by some accounts, the Texas lawmakers who drafted this, it's a way to effectively stop abortions from happening through deterrence, because the reports that we're seeing are that, you know, clinics and doctors who perform or participate in abortions are, can't afford to, don't want to be tied up in court with all of these possible lawsuits. And so many have simply stopped performing abortions once a fetal heartbeat is detected, at least for the moment in Texas.
That's right. But just imagine this. The receptionist who answers the phone and schedules an appointment meets the condition for aiding and abetting if an abortion is later performed and didn't meet the conditions. So what it in effect does is shut down anyone who might have any kind of association with the possibility that an abortion might be performed.
Yeah.
And
so from the perspective then of people who would like to see abortions not performed, this was quite successful. Like, this is a real end run around Roe versus Wade. Is that now just completely irrelevant in this framework?
So what's ultimately going to happen, there's still some argument going on in the lower courts to try to deal with this statute. But what eventually would happen is, let's suppose the undue burden analysis of Casey, that the state can't impose an undue burden on whatever the abortion right turns out to be. Let's suppose that some piece of that remains. And then a physician in Texas is the subject of a private civil complaint in Texas court, that would ultimately go up to the United States Supreme Court with the question would then be whether that award of a damage remedy imposes an undue burden on whatever remains of the abortion right.
I see. I see. So it would have to ultimately be, because the problem with the case that went before the Supreme Court that tried to stop this law from taking effect was that the conservative majority in a 5-4 ruling just very briefly said, you haven't proved that you're not suing the right people. you haven't found the right people to prove that that those people have caused the harm yet, law.
You don't have the relevant harm yet.
Right. So it would ultimately have to be an abortion provider or someone who gets sued who could then claim the harm and try to bring this, and bring this entire law up before the Supreme Court.
Now, something else to think about is that there are a lot of other sort of amazing questions raised by a statute like this. So I would assume that some people are going to leave Texas to have abortions. What would happen to the Uber driver who drives a woman to the airport, and she says on the way to the airport, "Thank you very much. You're enormously helpful to me in going to get my abortion." Or what would happen if some groups start helping people leave Texas for abortions? What does this do about our federalism? I mean, we have a country in which people feel free to travel from state to state. And so the statute is really extraordinary on so many grounds that don't really have anything to do with abortion itself.
But while these questions are being worked out in the courts and we're waiting for the people who can prove the proper harm to bring the challenges or resist the challenges, no matter how you fall on the issue of abortion itself, while all of that's getting worked out in the courts, is there anything to stop other states that would like to further restrict abortion from passing the identical law in their own legislatures?
Not if things continue to unfold the way they did in the Texas litigation.
Leslie Francis is a professor of law and philosophy at the University of Utah. Thanks for your time talking us through this today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Julie. I very much enjoyed talking with you as always.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up in about 15 minutes, the huge problem of bovine tuberculosis in the UK and why an alpaca named Geronimo is at the center of it. Just ahead, the calendar may say you are 48, but what does your body say? It's good to have you with us today for Top of Mind. Thank you for taking time. I'm Julie Rose. Age is just a number, as they say. And we all know people who seem much younger or older than what the calendar says. Researchers at Stanford think a more useful way to gauge age is to measure the age-related inflammation in a person's body. Those inflammatory cells can help predict how likely you are to develop cancer, heart disease, and degenerative disorders that get more common as we get older. Nazish Sayed is a professor of surgery at Stanford University working on this concept, and he's with us now. Dr. Sayed, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Jose. It's a pleasure to be here.
This inflammation-related age, which you call eye age for short, how close does it usually match a person's actual age?
So, the whole idea of the project was that we need to figure out, give a number. We always know every year we celebrate a birthday, we get a calendar year, we know we're getting older. But is our body getting older? Does the inflammation in our body, you know, the stresses of work, is it reflective of the age? So using artificial intelligence, what we did is, Julie, we were able to correlate the inflammatory age, which is inside the body, what is going on, to actually the calendar age. And, you know, we screen about 1,000 patients to get a good power on the study, and it accurately predicted exact inflammatory age, which was reflective of whatever disease they were carrying and they were coming at Stanford for, compared to the correlative calendar age. And I can give you an example. An individual could be much younger, but because of some heart disease, his or her inflammatory age was much higher.
So is that the common thing that that in the society we live in? I don't have any inflammatory diseases that I know of right now. So if you were to test my blood, do you think you would expect to find my inflammatory age just because I'm an American who works in the American economy, that my inflammatory age would be older than I actually am?
No, so, you know, it's just not the stress which we are dealing with, but it's also how our immune system is reacting to our environment. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, in California, here in Stanford, we have wildfires burning and we are breathing in the air. And what is that doing into the inflammatory system? See, you know, we know acute inflammation is good because the body is reacting right away and we're able to put a Band-Aid on a cut or get this acute inflammation out of the way. But what happens when this becomes chronic inflammation? Mm-hmm. What do? We usually, it's in a much subtle, sterile kind of inflammation, which we are just shrugging it off, saying that, oh, you know, you're fine. But over a period of time, this accumulates and has a big impact on our health. And that's something that we really wanted to capture here.
What is the difference between good inflammation and bad inflammation?
Well, you know, inflammation overall is not good, but, you know, an acute inflammation is something which happens right away. Your body tells you get a fever and the body is telling you right away that there is an acute inflammation. You need to do something about it.
So inflammation is fundamentally what, a signal to the immune system?
Right. It's a way your body is telling you that something is not right.
Okay.
Now, it could be as simple as I fall down and I cut myself. Or it could be I have an flu infection and I get fever. So that's your body telling you that something is not right. You need to do something about it. You know, usually acute inflammation, we have a bigger signal where we usually take, you know, care of it. But what happens when this becomes a chronic inflammation, such as cardiac disease or neurodegenerative disease, this accumulates a period of time where we usually are not paying attention. It's a sterile kind where there is not much, but this accumulation leads to it. That's something that we should be really worried about and should be taking care of it. So, you know, it's good
and
to
how
have
does,
a mixture.
Sorry, can you explain a little further, Dr. Sayed, what actually is inflammation? Do I have a bottle of it? Like, can you identify, point to it in my system and like put it somewhere? Or is it kind of just like an idea? What is it exactly?
Right. So, you know, inflammation overall is when, you know, I am reacting to a pathogen, or I'm reacting to an environmental hazard, or that's what inflammation is. It's when my immune system gets hyperactivated and trying to defend my internal organs, my blood, against all these non-self antigens which are right there in the environment.
Okay, that's so it's a state of activity then. Absolutely. For the immune system. And that might involve, you know, creating certain kinds of cells that are going to like float around in the blood and maybe try to go do stuff like heal a cut.
Exactly. So, you know, we know there are the white blood cells, which are the fighter cells in our body. They're going to be like, all right, we're going to go and defend the body against this kind of inflammation. We have cells which are, you know, to be a little more detailed, we're going to go right there to the wound and start healing it. These are called like macrophages. So that's what inflammation is. Your own body is trying to protect you.
Okay. And chronic inflammation then is where your immune system is sort of in a constant state of panic, trying to sort of fix something. And how does that end up causing trouble for parts of the body?
I mean, Julie, you're right. Exactly. The chronic inflammation is that below the radar kind of inflammation, which is persisting for years and we are just ignoring it and we're not dealing with it. But that accumulation of inflammation is something that will eventually lead to a chronic disease. And in our study, we focus on cardiovascular, because that's why, you know, being at the Stanford Cardiovascular Institute, we said we're going to hone on to vascular complications, cardiac complication, because of this chronic inflammation.
How does chronic inflammation cause problems for the heart and blood vessels?
Well, you know, you think about it, right? It's a double-edged sword. Inflammation will try to protect you, but if it is being secreted continuously, it's going to have an impact on your cardiac cells. It's going to have impact on your vascular cells, because our body is not meant to be producing these cytokines, these molecules which are continuously fighting. You know, once the pathogen has been taken care of, or this antigen, it's going to turn onto our own body and it's going to be, so we're not meant to be producing these cytokines which are going to be effect. Now, you have the subtle below the radar secretion of these molecules, inflammatory molecules, they're going to eventually turn onto our cells and start causing problems. That's how we start developing some kind of a cardiac disease. You know, in overall, it's called like fibrosis. Your cells are going to turn into non-reactive cells.
And this kind of inflammation, just sort of in the body, inappropriately in the body, increases as we age?
So absolutely it does. And, you know, we have to think about that aging is a much more complex phenomenon where we have so many different factors being produced. You know, we are going through the elements, as I, you know, spoke about. What if you're not eating healthy? You know, if you're not exercising, all of these factors are going to start accumulating. And as we age, we have our immune system, which is going to become more and more docile as we go along. And now we don't have that power to fight the pathogen, but if we are producing this at a very subtle level, it's going to start turning on to us. So aging is something that we really need to, you know, if you in lay terms, we can say that, you know, we see more of the diseases, cardiovascular, neuronal. These diseases are mostly seen in our elderly cohort.
And we think that's partly because of the year after year of compounding kind of chronic inflammation that exists in a person's.
Absolutely. And, you know, the idea is that if we can go back in time and we can say, hey, you know what, you know, when I was in the younger, I should have exercised more. Maybe I should have eaten much a little healthier. And is that something that we can do? And, you know, we try to focus on the study thinking about what we can do by, you know, looking into the future when you become older, but trying to see that something can be done for our other generation, the knowledge which we can get out of it.
So by measuring the level of inflammatory cells in a person's body, and then you run it through your artificially intelligent algorithm, you could spit out for me my inflammation-related age, my immune system, the age of my immune system, sort of how healthy it is. And you might be able, so I'm 47, you might be able to say, well, Julie, you're immune, you have the immune system of a 60-year-old because you clearly aren't eating healthy. and then that would be an opportunity for me to say, all right, if I stay on this path, then here are the age-related issues that I might be facing down the line.
I mean, you're right on the ball. Exactly. That's what it, you know, the adage goes, right? You're as old as your immune system. And this is exactly what the whole idea is, that is there any way we can provide this information that maybe this is a time that maybe we need to change our habits, maybe we need to start taking a statin or an antibiotic, you know, an antioxidant, vitamins, because this will help us boost our system. And the idea about this is that we're going to screen these many patients. Some have cardiac disease, some don't have. And whatever information we get, we can put a metric, a number to it to say, this is your eye age, which might reflect your calendar age, but might not. And is there something that we can do about it?
Would this concept have anything to do to offer in explaining why some people live to be 100 and something?
Absolutely. Beautiful. So we had a small cohort of patients who were 100 plus. These centenarians, you know, in living in Italy, in the study, were above 100, but the eye age was in the 50s. And it was amazing because we could track and say that they were eating healthy, they were exercising, they didn't have any bad habits, and they had an eye age which was so low and was reflective of their cardiac health. But, you know, the vice versa could be that someone who's much younger, but unfortunately because of, you know, eating not healthy, had an eye age which was in the 60s. And the idea is that can we do something now, you know, a stitch in time will save nine.
How much, though, of a person's immune function and inflammation is genetic versus driven by the choices that I make in my life?
This is a great question, Julie. I mean, you know, we know that genetics plays such an important role in this whole aspect. Absolutely, we know that, you know, certain cardiac diseases run in the family. But the focus of this, what we were trying to do is that we need to focus on the environmental aspects of this thing. And, you know, that's why that study did not include anyone who was having any kind of mutational or inherited diseases, because, you know, that, it's a small population, but absolutely spot on. Genetics plays an important role. But is there anything we can do to kind of give the information to the patients or individuals that, hey, it's time to improve your eye age by, you know, exercising or eating healthy?
You think the real value of this would be to scare people?
No, I think, you know, I really think this will give an informed, you know, good information to every individual. You know, we go in for our physical every year, right? We want to get a blood test. Why not add a panel where we can check our inflammatory status? You know, it's really just a blood test, right? And why not look at it and say, okay, you know what? We have this computer-driven algorithm which could spit out a metric, a number, and it can give us that, you know what, my inflammatory age, my, you know, there's inflammation in my blood. I need to do something about it. I think it gives more power to the individuals who don't have a disease or have a disease of being much more informed about it, that they need to do something about it. I think it's,
but
it's,
but don't you think that a primary care doctor who's been seeing a patient for a number of years, it's not a new patient, primary care doctor is going to have a pretty good sense as to what, you know, without having to actually run this diagnostic, don't you think?
No, they do. You know, but certain times we are a little, I mean, take the case of cancer. Usually we have this cancer growing in an individual for quite a bit of time. And because our primary care physician is just going to check our, you know, vitals and going to do a general test, we would not know what our internal inflammatory status is. And I think overall, general health, a primary care physician can give an idea about. But some diseases, cancer, neurodegenerative, Alzheimer's, for example, we don't know till it's a little too late. So the idea is that it could be more personalized in precision medicine, but we are much more informed ahead of time.
Najesh Sayad is a professor of vascular surgery at the Stanford Cardiovascular Institute. Thanks for taking time today, doctor. I appreciate it.
It was a pleasure being here.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, why did so many people in Britain protest the killing of an alpaca named Geronimo?
You're listening to Top of Mind. I'm Ciara Hewlett.
The center of a recent controversy in Britain is an unlikely figure, an 8-year-old alpaca named Geronimo. Thousands protested his impending execution with an online petition and in the streets. They waved signs that said, "Save Geronimo." But despite the protesters who took turns guarding the animal, Geronimo was taken into custody and killed last week. The animal tested positive twice for bovine tuberculosis, and there's a law in the UK that animals with tuberculosis must be euthanized. But protesters say the test is faulty. Bob Broadbent is on the line to explain. He's a veterinary surgeon in Gloucester who's examined Geronimo. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, very welcome.
It's one alpaca. Why did protesters make such a fuss over Geronimo?
Okay, so the issue with confusion with testing for TB in alpacas has been around for 30 or 40 years. And mostly people just can't afford the time and money and effort it takes to actually stand up to the Department of Agriculture in this country. As soon as you have an animal that tests, that they say has tested positive for TB, if you don't have it slaughtered, your movements are restricted on or off the farm. So you can't trade in or out of the farm. So if your livelihood depends on buying and selling animals, that's the end of that. So this particular owner has had no income for the last 4 years.
Wow.
And she's been fortunate enough to be able to, to stand up to the government for 4 years with no income. Most people just give in. They just
Difference here with this alpaca is that normally the government says, okay, your animal has tested positive, so you can't do any farm work. You've just got to sit, and then eventually the animal will be euthanized, and so the government will, or the farmer will just say, yes, go ahead and do it because I need money. I need to keep working my farm. But this particular instance, this woman had enough money, or however she did it, and she, this farmer, and she said, I can hold out here. I can protest.
That's correct. And she felt very strongly that the tests that they used were not appropriate for alpacas. This is the reason the owner has objected to his apparent failure. DEFRA say he failed the test, and she's saying, no, he didn't fail the test. He failed a cattle test, not an alpaca test.
Okay. And DEFRA, that's the Britain's...
That's the government's. Yeah, the Department for the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs. So it's the agriculture.
How often is this happening, that the government animals are testing positive for bovine tuberculosis and then they're being slaughtered?
I mean, cattle, it's, you know, thousands of animals per year are being slaughtered for TB. It's a major problem in the UK.
And why do they need to kill so many animals per year? How big of a problem is this bovine tuberculosis?
It's a production disease. I mean, it is an issue in that the animals that catch it can spread it to other animals if the disease progresses far enough. It's like TB in humans. If it develops enough within the body, it'll produce lung lesions. And then as they're breathing out, they can be breathing out the bacteria, which then spread to other animals. So, you know, it can spread from cattle to other cattle. It can spread from cattle to people, but it's really quite rare now. I mean, in the UK last year, we had about 8,000 people with tuberculosis, but it's not the same bug. Of those 8,000 that had tuberculosis, only about 20 or 30 had the type of TB that we suspect Geronimo's got. So the cattle strain of TB, which is what the government say Geronimo has got, is now very rare in people. So,
and the fear is that if they don't euthanize animals as they test positive for this, that it might spread to humans. But the larger fear would be that it'd spread across cattle and then kill off large swaths of cows.
Yeah, yeah. And the disease in cattle is really not well under control. And there's been an ongoing row within the agriculture industry about how we ought to deal with it. The only thing that everybody agrees on is that whatever the government have done has not worked.
If this tuberculosis disease in cattle is such a problem,
it seems like it would be a good thing. People would be happy that the government is taking animals that test positive and killing them. So why do people, why are they protesting?
They're protesting because the test that they used in Geronimo is not validated. It's like, say you go to take your driving test, and when you get there, they make you take a test to drive a lorry. They call it a heavy goods vehicle license in this country. I don't know what the one in America is called, but you go along and they give you an inappropriate test and you fail it. And you say, I want to take this test again, please, because I want to drive my car. And you go back again and they make you take the test for the heavy goods vehicle and you fail it again. And they say, right, that's it. You can't drive. And you say, but you gave me the wrong test. And they say, it doesn't matter. You failed the test. You can't drive. And it's the same thing with Geronimo. He failed the test twice, but it's not the test that we know works in alpacas.
Is it?
The government are using the cattle test to try and clear up every last possible animal that may have TB.
Is it better than nothing, though?
Well, the point is that there is a test that works well in alpacas. We know how it works. We know that it produces almost no false positive results. And that's not what they used. And the owner, after he failed twice, the owner said, okay, look, I will keep him on the farm. I won't ever move him off the farm. Come back and test him using the proper test. And you can come back every month if you want, or every week, and keep testing him.
Does the test work well in cows, though, in cattle?
The test that they use on Geronimo works well in cows, and we know that it does produce some false positives, but there is such a big problem in cows that they're really working on a numbers game. You know, they just need to get rid of as many animals as they possibly can. This is what the government feel. They're really on a, if it's at all possible that this animal's got it, we're going to slaughter it. And because it's very much a commercial enterprise, the cattle industry, people tend to put up with it. But even the farmers are getting very fed up now with this, the number of animals that are being slaughtered. You know, it's gone on for such a long time, and the figures relating to the incidence of TB in cattle really aren't changing. You know, we're just getting absolutely nowhere.
So this protest then isn't just about, you know, animal rights, don't kill this alpaca, it's innocent, no. But also just a larger problem of, the government needs to figure out a better way to do this. And is it also affecting farmers' income that every time the government comes in and takes out one of these cattle, it stops all production, stops everything from happening on the farm, and that's actually causing problems for farmers?
Yeah. So if you, in most of the areas of the UK, and certainly in the area that I live in, where TB is a problem, all the cattle have to be tested every single year for TB. And if any of your cattle fail, from the day you fail the test, you can move nothing on or off the farm. If you sell unpasteurized milk, you can't sell it. If you sell unpasteurized cheese or yogurt, you can't sell it. And you have to wait then for 2 months before you have another test, and you have to have two clear tests at 60-day intervals before you can move any animals on or off the farm
and start selling again. That would be a lot for a farmer.
It's a lot. And if you have a clear test and then 2 months later you have another animal fail, you're back to square one again. You're given compensation for the animals, but it's not quite market value. And it doesn't take into account the fact that you then lost that animal's production. So it may be a pregnant cow, so you've lost the calf inside, or you've lost the genetics that you may have bred for years to get that animal. It may be your prize bull, a show-winning bull, but all you get is the market value for slaughter for that bull. So he may be worth, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, but what you'll actually get perhaps is a couple of thousand, which would be his killing price.
And then on top of that, the lost money in stopping production, they're not compensated for that. Yeah. I'm speaking with veterinary surgeon Bob Broadbent. He's in the UK, where they have a major problem with bovine tuberculosis, and they recently killed an alpaca named Geronimo that was suspected to have tuberculosis. Did Geronimo actually, with the autopsy, he was killed? Does he have tuberculosis?
Okay, so he was killed last week, and the initial postmortem, the owner wanted an independent vet to be there at the postmortem, and the government refused permission. So they did it behind closed doors. They then waited best part of a week before they disclosed any information. And what they've come up with and said is that they have found three lesions atypical of TB. A lesion basically is, you know, an abnormal piece of tissue. So the fact that you found three lesions in an eight-year-old alpaca is not at all surprising. One of them was in a lymph node in his neck. Well, we know that he had a jaw abscess earlier on in the year, so that's quite likely a bit of scar tissue left over from that. And then he had another lesion in his liver and another one in the lymph nodes around his gut, which may have been due to migrating parasites. These are not uncommon findings. But the important thing is what DEFRA has said is that the lesions they found at post-mortem were atypical of TB. That means they're not typical. They're not the sort of lesions they would have expected to find had they had had he had TB.
Which is not surprising to you or anyone who's protested, as we've discussed, because it wasn't an alpaca test. It was a cattle test. So now what? He was killed anyway.
He was killed anyway. So what will happen now is that they will take those lesions and bits and pieces, and they will mix it up in a soup and try and culture the bug, try and grow the Mycobacterium bovis bug, the TB bug. And that may take them several months because it's very, very slow growing. And they will give it every opportunity to grow before they admit that that it's not there. And the big issue we'll then have to field is that what they generally say is, okay, so we didn't find any visible lesions at post-mortem that were typical of TB, and we have failed to culture the bug after 23 weeks of culturing, but just because we didn't find it does not mean it wasn't there. That's the standard reply for queries about animals that have been killed and found nothing.
So you don't think, even if they don't find tuberculosis, that anything will change?
I don't think they'll ever admit that he didn't have it. We have got blood taken from him before he died, which at some stage we will have tested with the test that is validated in alpacas to see if it comes back positive. And I think either way, DEFRA will lose, because if the blood test comes back negative and they found nothing, then to my mind, they will have been proved wrong. If they grow something on post-mortem and then the blood test comes up positive to say he does have TB, they could have done that 4 years ago. This was all we've been asking for the last 4 years, really, is use the validated test, use the one that we know works in alpacas. And then the owner had said at the time, she said 4 years ago, 2 years ago, this year, test him again using the proper test. And if he fails it, you can take him. But they've refused to do that.
What do you think needs to happen to fix this bovine tuberculosis problem so that we don't have alpacas and also lots of cows being killed all the time, and you know, which is stopping farmers' productivity, and as you said, it's not always accurate, and it's kind of, they're just kind of using a catch-all approach right now. What do you think needs to happen instead?
It would be really good if they would sit down with people who have an interest, a scientific interest, and listen to the scientific argument, because they made the laws and the rules regarding TB, and they just stick very dogmatically to it in the worst way that, that you can interpret dogma, that that's the rule, that's what we're doing. You know, and in Geronimo's case, we said right at the beginning, well, you're saying he's got TB, but how can he have TB? He's come from a farm in New Zealand that's never, ever had a problem. Nobody else has ever tested positive. And you've used this unvalidated test. Don't you think that might be an issue? Let's use the proper test and see. And they've just said, nope, he failed the test. That's it. He's got to die.
So you think that the government just needs to start thinking outside of the box more instead of just sticking to what they've done forever and what the rules are and just living by the law, you know, and the letter of the law, that they need to start thinking differently about this? Because it is a major problem, tuberculosis in yeah. cattle, but they just need to start thinking differently.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're being kind by saying thinking outside the box. I think it's within the box. It's just looking at the science. They just need to look at the evidence that's available and not just stick very strictly to the rules that they have made. This all went to court, as I'm sure you know, and the owner lost the right to appeal at court because the judge said that she could find no evidence to say that. You know, the case should proceed. But then when she was winding up, she said that in making her judgment, she'd taken no account of the scientific evidence. She'd looked purely at the legality of the decision of DEFRA to kill him. And that was basically, the law says that if he fails a test to TB, he must die. He'd fail the test, therefore he must die. And that's all she'd considered. She hadn't, despite months of preparation for the court case, she didn't take any of the science into account. And that's what we need the government to start doing.
Bob Broadbent is a veterinary surgeon in Gloucester. Thank you so much for your time today for explaining this for us. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I'm Ciara Hewlett. This is Top of Mind.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. First, lionfish can wreak havoc on coral reef ecosystems. We've got the inventor of a lionfish hunting robot joining us to explain how it works and how it was inspired by the Roomba. Then, teamwork is an inevitable part of life and inevitably tough sometimes. How can you turn a dysfunctional team into a success? It's ahead on Top of Mind. Thanks for joining us. The annual Lionfish Derby is happening in the Florida Keys. Teams compete to catch the most lionfish in a single day. There are cash prizes and also lionfish tastings. And it's all organized by an environmental nonprofit called Reef to raise awareness of the problem lionfish pose to reef ecosystems. An engineering collaboration called Robots in Service of the Environment is designing a lionfish hunting robot that might someday be able to win the Lionfish Derby if robots are allowed to enter. Erica Engel is on the line to explain the concept. She's co-founder of Robots in Service of the Environment. Hi there, Erica. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is the problem with lionfish?
Well, you know, it's an unfortunate thing, but a number of years ago, as the story goes, an individual or some individuals in Florida who had some lionfish, and again, if folks have actually seen a lionfish, but they're very beautiful fish with sort of spines and projections coming out of their back and their sides, dumped their lionfish into the ocean in Florida. And the trouble, of course, with this was that the lionfish was native to the Indo-Pacific region and is an invasive species in the Atlantic. So they have no natural predators in the Atlantic. And what this has meant that over the last 20 or 30 years, they have been proliferating uncontrollably and literally spreading from as far north as Boston to the Southern Caribbean. And now one of the big problems is they replicate every, you know, gosh, I mean, they give off 30 to 40,000 eggs every 4 to 5 days, and they eat juvenile reef fish. So this is obviously devastating for fish populations, but also for reef health in general. So
four to 5,000 eggs every 5 days, just during 40 their
50,000.
Oh, just during their yeah. mating season, or just all the time.
Literally all the time. I mean, this is why Whoa. The numbers are, I mean, if you imagine a horror movie at depth where they tend to proliferate, it's almost like, you know, you have football fields of these lionfish, which are typically very, you know, difficult to reach even for traditional divers. This is why it's been such a terrible and horrible problem.
And they're carnivorous, so they're eating other fish, and they're just very hungry. So they just can't.
Yeah. They eat baby reef fish, and they don't really have great, they just keep eating, right? So if you catch one and you, a little gross, but if you cut it open, what you'll often find in these really big lionfish is that they're just full of these tiny little baby fish. Wow. It's rather grotesque.
Like they're just gulping them down. Okay, yes. So they're ravenous, they're populating they reproduce very rapidly, and there's nothing to keep them in check. So I guess in the Indo-Pacific where they're native, there are other bigger fish that will eat them, or sharks or something
Correct. Yeah, so there are certain types of grouper in the Indo-Pacific, so certain types of fish that will eat them, but those fish don't exist in the Atlantic.
Okay. So they're just untouchable. I mean, they're the lions. They're the king of the hill in these reefs. And specifically, they congregate around these reefs just because that's where the reef fish are. So it's like, you know, it's the buffet for them.
Right. Okay. Right. I mean, so they tend to sort of replicate at depth, and then they come to the reefs in order to grow up. Right. So they will spawn at greater depths, and they'll come and feast, snack away on these poor juvenile reef fish on the reefs, which, you know, those fish, of course, responsible for cleaning the reefs and keeping the reefs alive. And so this whole thing cascades into a pretty poor situation for reef health.
What happens when the reef fish are not there to clean off the keeping the reefs clean?
Well, things like, for example, like the corals might die, right? Mm-hmm. Because there are certain algae and things that grow on them. So if those little reef fish aren't there to eat the algae, then the corals will die.
And what has been so this happened, unintended consequence, now they're invasive. What have the approaches been to try to rein in the lionfish population or eradicate it?
You know, there have been different strategies. You know, predominantly folks have been trying to just capture them through whether it's, you know, spear fishing. Obviously, you have the lionfish derby, right? So this is an incentive for conventional divers to be able to go and capture as many as possible. But, you know, again, the challenge is that at the depths where traditional diving can happen, you can only address so much of the problem because a lot of the replication happens at further depth. And that's beyond the reach of a normal, you know, scuba diver. Even rebreather divers can't even go that deep. So there's only so much that you can do if your technology only allows you to stay at a certain depth. But, you know, predominantly that's been the strategy.
Just
spear fishing. Yeah. Going and catching them.
And lionfish, are they sought after as food or as, I mean, pets? Obviously they were once in an aquarium. That's as the story goes. Or is there no market for lion fishing?
So there is. So that's part of sort of the good news, is that they are edible. They're, you know, if you're a fish fan, they're relatively tasty. They're sort of a white flaky fish, and you can eat them as ceviche. You can cook them. You can make soup out of them. So they are edible. And they also, you know, if you can catch enough of them, then, you know, stores will actually sell them. The challenge has been to get enough of them for there to be a viable market, which is, again, one of the reasons why we ended up doing what we're doing, because if you can create a sustainable way to catch them, then you really create a market where, you know, a Whole Foods or another market will work with you in order to sell them. The challenge has just been it's very difficult to consistently get enough fish in order for there to be a business model that works for a store trying to stock them.
And so how does the robot work that your team has been developing?
Absolutely. So it's a little like a video game, but imagine a large tube, and you come up to the lionfish, and you're piloting this with a almost like a game controller, like a video game.
Up on land, your remote control.
Up on land, right? Okay. Or on a boat. Okay. You know, if you're on a boat and you deploy the robot into the water and you have a computer screen, you can pilot it. So it goes forward, backward, left, right, up, down. And you can come up to a lionfish and you suck it. Essentially, you can suck it into the tube, and the tube has two paddles on its sides. So if you can come around the lionfish with the two paddles and apply an electric charge, so it basically zaps them, it stuns them, and then it sucks them in to the tube. Still alive, but stunned. And the tube holds, you know, I'd say 10 to 15 lionfish at a time. So if you go to an area that's pretty thickly populated, you can collect them all. And then, you know, you bring the robot back to the surface, you empty the fish, and then you can redeploy the robot.
Huh. And so it's just hoovering them up. It's just a vacuum.
Basically, yes.
Okay.
Robot vacuum.
Yeah, which I understand it was in part inspired by robot vacuums, like the Roomba. Tell me about that connection.
Sure. So my husband is the CEO and co-founder of iRobot, and we were actually diving. We're both scuba divers, so we were diving in Bermuda and with a bunch of friends, and we actually noticed on the reef these lionfish. And when we surfaced, we asked our friends, we said, well, what's going on here, right? Because these are not supposed to be here. And they said, well, yeah, let me tell you about this. This is a big problem. That's how we learned, you know, of this situation. And they sort of jokingly said, well, you know, you guys build robots. You're the Roomba guy. Like, why don't you build a robot who that can suck up the lionfish? So, you know, here we are. And that's what we do.
Okay. It doesn't harm the fish. And so the idea would be, and you said how many, it'll hold 15 of these fish before it has to go and discharge its collection.
Yeah, it depends on the size, but between 10 and 15. And what makes it really interesting is, you know, traditionally when you deploy a robot like this, you know, all other fish are, you know, because they do have predators, they will swim away. So, you know, we often get questions around, well, are you going to be catching other fish that you shouldn't be actually fishing for? You know, what is the bycatch problem? It's less of an issue because the lionfish, because they have no predators, literally don't move. They kind of float in space in the ocean, whereas all the other fish, of course, swim away. So,
so they're not hard to catch if you can get to where they are, it sounds like.
They are not, because they have no fear because there's nothing to get them.
Yeah. Except along comes your fish Roomba. And is it possible at this point, it has to be remote controlled by a human looking at a video game console, right? A screen. I guess there's like a GoPro on the front of it or something. But could it be automated so that just like the Roomba can vacuum without me having to control it? Could this be somehow automated to suck up lionfish without a human having to guide it?
Absolutely. I think, you know, the long-term goal is for there to be more automation involved, and even object recognition, right? So the lionfish are very distinctive in the way that they look, so that the robot could actually identify, you know, similarly to how, you know, Roomba knows when there's certain furniture or which room it's in, you know, the robot could scan and find the lionfish because it is very distinctive. And then, you know, again, only be deployed and only be allowed to capture things that look like a lionfish. And, you know, that's involves, I think it's a future kind of iteration of the robot, but it's definitely something that we've talked about.
Erica Engel is the co-founder of Robots in Service of the Environment. Thanks for your time today. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, teamwork is an inevitable part of life, and it's inevitably tough. How can you turn a dysfunctional team into a success? This is Top of Mind. It's great to have you with us. I'm Julie Rose. The success of humans as a species on this planet is due, in part, to our unusual capacity to cooperate. We cooperate more generously and on a larger scale than any animal. So why then is teamwork so hard? Why are so many teams dysfunctional? Whether it's at work or school or church or in the community, I am sure you've been on at least one bad team. It's inevitable. Facilitator and leadership trainer Valerie Patrick calls her new book a repair guide for successful teamwork. It's called When Bad Teams Happen to Good People, and it's full of tips that all of us could be using right now in our lives or will soon have a need for. Valerie Patrick is with me now. Welcome. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Julie. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Why do you think it is that teamwork is so hard when it's also fundamental to being human?
Yeah, you're right. It's a great question because, as you said, humans are social beings. So teamwork should come naturally to us. And I think it does actually come naturally to us. But I think it's because teamwork is harder than we actually give it credit. Teamwork is hard because a team is actually a complex adaptive system with many factors at play. Now, a complex adaptive system is a system that can evolve into something totally different on its own. So we can take the example of a lake. So we fish on a lake. We can ride boats on the lake. We swim in it. There's runoff into the lake from rain on the properties and fields surrounding the lake. And depending on how much rain there is or how many little kids pee in the lake or what wildlife is in the lake, the lake can produce a crystal clear water that's perfect for swimming conditions on one day. And then it can produce an algae bloom that's actually dangerous for swimming on a different day. So there's many different types of inputs that can affect your experience with the lake or what I will call your outcomes. And the same is true of a team, only it can be more complex. So each team member represents a different input into that team, but so do the pressures that each team member faces. So do the experience the team member has maybe on the way to the team meeting, and so do the events that could be going on in that team member's lives. When you put all those inputs together on any given day, the outcomes from the team can really vary a lot, and it depends on even more things than just what's happening with each team member. So it depends on the traits of the team leader, the outcomes of that team. It can depend on the quality of the climate when those people get together, and it can depend on how that meeting is facilitated. So there's just a lot of factors that you have to take into account and keep track of.
Valerie Patrick, you trained as a chemical engineer. You got a PhD in chemical engineering. You worked for a couple of decades at Bayer and Monsanto. How do you end up a leadership trainer and facilitator?
Yeah, that's a really good question that I ask myself a lot. I think part of it is I grew up in a big family. I grew up the oldest. I have three brothers. So I think you get exposed to figuring out how to get along in an environment like that. So you develop some social skills. And I think it's just something that came to me over time. I got assigned my first team probably within 3 or 4 years of working in the corporate environment. And it scared me a lot. So I did what I do. I bought a lot of books about teamwork to try to figure out what it was and what I needed to do. So I've been a bookworm about teamwork for quite a long time, continue to learn about it because realized it's pretty complex. And just when I thought I had it figured out, I didn't. Kind of like golf, you know, just when you think you have your swing figured out, you don't. Something goes wrong. So teamwork was really like that. So I really became a continual learner in it. And I got good at it because it seemed like everyone would come to, not everyone, but it seemed like I had a lot of team opportunities brought my way. So, yeah.
You got put on teams specifically because people were thinking, Valerie's good on teams. let's put her on this team, or this could be a problem area. Let's send Valerie over there to see if she can bring the ship back into line.
Exactly. Mm. I was put on all the challenging teams.
Like what? Can you think of an example you could share?
mostly I was put on teams to lead technical people. And this is because technical people can be challenging on a team. I think a natural inclination of technical people, and this could be true of other professionals as well, is they tend to focus on content and they can deep dive into content. And that's not always helpful. When you want to have a really good team, you need to keep in mind where you're headed. You know, what's that outcome that you're headed towards and how are you going to get there? And why is it important to get there, to get everyone on the path? And then they can figure out how their expertise fits into that. And that's where your focus has to be, is how content serves the process to get to the outcomes. And somehow I was just a bit of a natural at that. So I think that's why I ended up. But yeah, I've got lots. All right. One example comes to mind of a, it's not really a bad team example, but it's an example of an awkward moment. Let's say that. So I was asked to run a session on helping a group of executives develop some metrics for this, for their organization. And as is typical, I wasn't given a lot of team to do it, like work miracles, you know, that type of thing. So I prepared a fairly large pre-read because I needed to get people all in the same place, on the same, you know, on a level playing field going into the meeting so we could hit the ground running. So I prepared this big pre-read and I gave it to the sponsor of this team, who was the executive director, to approve it ahead of time, which he did, and I sent it out. And so the meeting starts and Julie, it was maybe 5 minutes in, maybe even faster. The executive director was all over me for one comment made in the pre-read that I don't agree with that. That's inaccurate. And oh my, it was so tempting to say, but you approved it. But that it would have, the whole meeting would have devolved. That would have been the absolute wrong thing to do. But I had a plan, right? I had a plan for that meeting and what was going to happen. So I was able to take a look at his content in terms of the, and he was a technical professional. I was able to take a look at his content in the context of the process of what we were doing in the meeting. And I realized, okay, that might be wrong, but actually that's not going to influence how the plan for the meeting. And then I thought about, well, what could that influence? And what it could influence was prioritizing the outcomes from the meeting. So I was able to say, you know, thank you for bringing that up. That's not going to influence what we're going to do today, but we do want to keep that in mind as something to address after the meeting, because that'll be helpful to help prioritize the input we gather in this meeting. So I was able to put it on, you know, the so-called parking lot so that we would, they could use that, address that after the meeting. So that that happened to work out, but yeah.
I mean, in what way could that have gone badly? Like what response would have sort of taken
things
off
the rail? It would have turned into an ego battle, right? So I would have said, well, you approved the pre-read. And then he would have got defensive, you know, right? Yeah. Like, well, yeah, I know I approved the pre-read. And you didn't correct this, or, you know, it would have got, I probably would have got blamed for something there. Yeah. That would be my guess. And I would have lost some power, right? And credibility. So then it would have affected my ability to facilitate that meeting and people follow me, right? So that would have been hard.
So walk us through the some of the important aspects of a successful team process.
You want to have, so what I typically do for a given meeting is I'll ask the person I'm working with or myself, if I'm running that meeting. All right, let's say the meeting happened and I'm really happy about it. Why am I happy? What needs to happen in that meeting to make me happy? So that's kind of your, what does success look like for the meeting? Mm-hmm. So once you understand what that looks like, so let's say, we have some prioritized action items for a given goal, right? Okay, so once I know that, then I need to ask, all right, is there information, is there content? This is where the content comes in. Is there content that we have that would help towards that? And if so, I might gather that up. I might make a a one-pager to kind of summarize it so it's easy access for everyone. Or I might find out in asking that question, you know what? No, there's not. We're missing some content. So is there some content gathering that needs to happen before we can have an effective meeting? That would be another question I would ask. If there's content gathering, there needs to be some survey of some people. Maybe it's some internet searching work, and gathering that. So then you'd want to do that before you have the meeting. Or maybe the people in the meeting are the ones that are best able to generate that content. So now I have a different step before I can actually get to that other step of some information gathering. And then we might have to categorize that information or put it into some kind of form, which will be helpful to get to those outcomes. So you just sort of jump forward and look, where am I going? And then you come back and what are the steps that are going to be needed to get there when I'm dealing with a group? You don't want to get a group together and then no one talks or has input. So what you're trying to design is why is things that are going to use everyone that's in the group. Otherwise, what's the point of having the group together, right?
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the things that can go wrong in a team or that can slow down a team's success. So one of them is something I've experienced quite a bit, which is that the team doesn't have like a clear leader. This is inclined to happen when you're like a subcommittee of the PTA. You're sort of all equally in charge and you're kind of all, there's like no clear, you know, authority within the group or, like class assignments. This is partly why I really hated team assignments in college, because it would be like, all right, you four are in a team. Does the team always need a leader in order to succeed?
I don't think a team always needs a leader in order to succeed, because you can have distributed leadership models. There's a researcher, Amy Edmondson, I think she's at Harvard, who talks about a concept called teaming, which is the idea of the teams that just come together, right, on the spot.
Right.
And she talks about, her research focuses on the psychological safety that you need to make that effective.
Mm, what's that? So psychological safety.
Yeah. So she talks about it in terms of that everyone needs to be comfortable bringing their perspective forward of maybe saying something that's not quite right, and the other people are there to support them. So it's being able to put yourself out there and not feel like you're going to get attacked or belittled or otherwise have your social needs messed with. So
where does that come from?
Oh, go ahead.
Where does that come from, this psychological safety, if you don't have a leader sort of establishing it?
So it's a behavioral thing. So you'd have to have at least one person in there who's familiar with it and who's savvy enough to help others practice it, right? Mm-hmm. So, it's basic things like she talks about, you need a curiosity for, so it could be one person that comes and wants to figure out, okay, how can your perspective help with what we're tasked to do? So you want to get that out of each person there. So it's like it could be an informal leader, I guess, but at least one person has to have the savvy to know how to do that. Mm. So that's one aspect of it, drawing people in. And then the other aspect of it is being able to say you don't know everything. Like, I don't know. That's the other part of psychological safety. And so if someone starts attacking someone, well, we should know this. Well, someone's got to stand up and say, well, no, it's okay. We're in a team. We're here. That's part of what a team does. Some people have knowledge over here. And if we don't have the knowledge in the team, then we have to go outside and get it and bring it back. So, you have to have that civility, particularly when a team is just thrown together like that.
Mm. And what about if all members of the team are not contributing equally? Like, first of all, do they need to be contributing equally in order for a team to be successful?
Yeah, so I guess it depends on what you mean by contributing equally. So there's a researcher, Dr. Anita Woolley, out of Carnegie Mellon University. She studies collective intelligence. And through her work, she has found that team performance correlates with the degree of equal participation during an actual meeting. So in a meeting, you really do want to have as much equal participation as you can in order to have, you know, the best performance of that team. So that could be, you know, sometimes you have a mixture of introverts and extroverts on a team. So the extroverts are people who tend to think out loud, right? They process information by talking. That's just their personality. Whereas introverts are different. They process information internally, not by talking. So they can appear like they're not participating. So one thing I think that's helpful when you have a particularly diverse team is to make sure you do plan breaks to help those introverts be able to participate. But you can also...
Wait, how does that work? If an introvert is processing internally, so they're not really chiming in and, you know, adding to the brainstorm session or to the problem solving discussion that you're having, how does a break facilitate their participation?
So a break gives them some time to further process their thoughts so they can come back and be ready to participate. They need that space, you know, for processing.
I see. Because at some point they will, or they can be expected to voice their ideas. They just they're just processing in a different way.
Yeah. Or you can design the process. So with brainstorming, you can do brainstorming with post-it notes. And so that allows people, so you start off by saying, okay, everyone, I want you to sit at your seat, come up with just at least three starting ideas. And so that's quiet time, and everyone does that. That can also help level the playing field between introverts and extroverts.
What do you do when there is someone who's just someone on your team who's doing a lot of the work, taking a lot of the assignments? And this is outside of the meeting. So, you know, you've got your action items, but you come back together and it turns out there's one. This used to happen a lot in class assignments, right? You've got somebody who's doing a lot of the work and somebody who's just coasting along. What do you do in a situation like that?
So I think often that happens because there's not clarity at the end of the meeting of what needs to be done and who's going to do what. So that could just be that you could try. I mentioned an action item exercise in the book where you basically write down where everyone can see. These days it's probably on a computer screen. Okay, here's the action items. Here's the people assigned to it. And then you actually ask the person assigned to it, what does this mean to you? What are you going to do? I think sometimes that happens because people just don't really, like, they'll nod in the meeting, but they don't. Then they get away and they realize, I don't really know what I'm supposed to do, you know?
Right.
So you could do that where you force them before you leave. What does this mean to you? So that you're also on the same page for quality of work or what work's expected, because that can vary. So I think having that discussion around the actions. So what are you going to do? What does this mean to you? And then for like, I don't know, then you need to have further discussion before you leave, and maybe that'll help. Mm.
I'm speaking with Valerie Patrick, who is a certified facilitator. She's a leadership trainer and author of a book called When Bad Teams Happen to Good People, Your Complete Repair Guide for Successful Teamwork. We have to take a very quick break here on Top of Mind. When we come back, we'll talk about what the ideal team looks like. What's a dream team, and how can you engineer that for a team that you're on? I'm Julie Rose. Stay with us. It's great to have you with us today for Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Speaking with Valerie Patrick, she is author of a book called When Bad Teams Happen to Good People. And the fact is that bad teams happen to basically everybody. So her book is A Complete Repair Guide for Successful Teamwork. Valerie Patrick is a certified facilitator and leadership trainer. Describe for me a dream team, if you will. And in concrete terms, can you describe one that you've either worked with or been on? What did it feel like? How did it function? How do you know it was a dream team?
So I have to say the first dream team that comes to my mind is one of the an early team that I was asked to lead. And this is going to really date me, Julie, so be kind. This was a team where we were still in the days of there were no laptops yet. You know, we still had those terminals that we did our work on. And I was asked to lead a team to put a laptop on every scientist's desk. So this was new. This was a long time ago. And I was allowed to pick my members. So that was great. I was able to pick people I knew. And the objective was something we all wanted. We were all very motivated to do this because we all wanted to have computers on our desks. So we had to pick out the software and the hardware and all that. And then we got the money to go out and buy them all and put them on people's desks. So that was a dream team because we wanted it. People were happy about the change we were making. And I knew all the people on the team. So we just clicked. It went very easily.
Okay, let's say it was a goal that was really difficult, where there wasn't a clear solution, or you knew that it was going to be painful, that you're on this team, there's going to be a lot of hard work, it's not going to be super popular at all times, and maybe some members of the team are not super thrilled that they've been asked to be on this team. What does a dream team look like, a dream team experience look like in a case like that?
Yeah, I've been on those teams too. So I think a dream team experience looks like an experienced leader. And by that, I mean someone who has some of those mindsets that are so important to teamwork and someone who has high resilience, right? Because if you're leading a team doing something that's hard and that people aren't going to like, there's going to be pushback. There's going to be moments when the team's down, you have to pick them back up again. There's going to be a lot of barriers. So that team leader has to have a lot of resilience to keep coming back. And I talk about, you know, how to build that resilience by, getting your well-being in all the different dimensions of well-being that are so important for us as humans and for our brains to function properly. So that's really, really important. You also need to make sure that the team members are a good representation of the people that are going to be impacted by the team's work, particularly the people that are going to be impacted in ways they might not be happy about. So you definitely want to have those voices on your team so that you know what kind of impacts you're having, and then you can best mitigate against those impacts or do whatever you can to show that the benefit outweighs the badness. You have to work in that way to show that the benefits outweigh what are going to be maybe some short-term pain. There's going to be some longer-term benefits. So that'll be really important. And you're going to have a really supportive climate for innovation on a team like that, because if it's hard work and you don't quite know how you're going to get there and there's going to be barriers coming up, well, the team's going to have to come up with ideas when those barriers come up, how we're going to get around that barrier. And the team's going to have to do some problem solving, which the harder the problem, the more creativity and innovation that you need to have. And there's been a lot of research on the climate needed to support innovation.
What is climate? If I'm on a committee and I'm looking around me in these meetings that we're having, what is the climate?
So climate is just how you feel in that meeting. It's the accumulated behaviors of the people there. So do you feel like open, like you can put stuff out there and you're going to be supported? Or do you feel like guarded, like, oh, I got to be careful what I say in this meeting? So it really gets down to how you feel interacting in that meeting. And the only way to really get a handle on it, because it can vary so much from one team to another, it can change if one team member leaves and a new person comes on. The climate can totally change. And it doesn't even have to be the leader that changes. The only way to really get your handle on it is to do a climate survey. You know, basically asking people, you know, how are they feeling about participating and about other team members? And, you know, that's how you get your hands around it. And there are things you can do to change that climate. Particularly, the team leader probably has the biggest influence on the climate of a team.
Like what? What do you do to establish a climate that works for the team?
So you might find out from the survey that people don't feel their ideas are getting listened to. Okay. So what a team leader can do is just write everything down, everything, all ideas down so that they're getting listened to. And just in the process of writing, that delays the tendency to judge, because that often is what happens when people don't feel listened to. Maybe their idea just gets dismissed or comments made about it. So that can be a change behavior to help with that.
What are some tips or tricks that you recommend for leaders of teams to establish a good climate from that very first meeting? Because, you know, if you're all coming into it, it seems to me like that establishing the climate from that very first meeting would be critical. Otherwise, you're going to have to do a lot of remediation down the line. So what are some of the practices that you recommend for team leaders?
Yeah, so one thing I like to do as a team leader is first do a draft charter. It can be pretty high level. It's going to be a draft because the team will actually make the charter. But just by getting something down on paper, I think is very important. And usually there's someone who wants this team, right? So that's something you can work on with the person who's sponsoring this team. You can make sure that you understand what they want the team to do. So the charter will have what you see as the mission of the team, the vision possibly of that team. So that's the vision is what the future will look like if the mission is totally accomplished. That will have like what you see as the primary goals and objectives and the rough timeline. Like here's the goals. So I think it'll take us, you know, 2 months to do this, another 5 months to do this. And it helps break it down to steps. Mm. And then you can work on with the sponsor, you know, is this on track? Am I missing something? You know, and I think that's important for the team leader to be on the same page as that sponsor early on. Another thing you can do is if you're working on something that you think could be controversial in some way, one thing I do is I call up team members before that first team meeting and I just do a little mini interview with them or visit them in their office, you know, either way, and just say, you know, hey, I heard there might be some concerns with this, what we're trying to do on this team, anything you want to share with me, you know, before going into the team meeting. Mm. And that gives you a little bit of a leg up of some, you know, bombs that might be dropped in that first meeting that you might not be prepared for. At least now you're prepared for what some of those things might be, and you can do some homework ahead of time. But the other thing that does, if you get to interview people ahead of time, is you can learn a little bit about them. What are their interests? What are some of their talents? What are kind of the things they like to do? And that's really helpful to a team leader because then you can better match actions, you know, follow up action items with their talents.
Is it necessary to spend time in your meetings doing team building exercises?
So my opinion on that is that I want to make good use of people's time in a meeting. And what I try to do with if the team is just getting together, I do try to do a first exercise in the beginning of a team meeting to help people get to know each other better. What I try to do is make that exercise relevant to what we're trying to do in that meeting. Mm. So let's say we need to do some brainstorming in that meeting. Then I might do a fun brainstorm that will help people get to know each other in the beginning. So that's getting them into the mindset that they're going to need for brainstorming later and getting them practicing those skills.
What do you mean a fun brainstorm? Like a brainstorm about each other?
So it could be a brainstorm of places to go on vacation or, you know, something like that.
Okay. So people are sharing things about themselves, but in the format of a brainstorm.
Yeah.
And Valerie Patrick, how do you recover from a bad start as a team?
Sometimes there are emotions get the better of us in a team. I often think that those types of situations are best handled offline. When you're emotional, whether it's you or team members, we know that that turns off your thinking brain. You know, if you get to a certain level of emotion, negative or positive, mostly negative though, when your brain gets to a certain level of negative emotion, your brain goes into defense mode. It goes, okay, we're threatened in some way. It could be a, it could just be a social threat. These days we don't have, you know, saber-toothed tigers chasing us. We have social threats that our brain responds to. And so the brain says, okay, this is, we're threatened. We got to save all our resources for that fight or flight. Mm. And so the resources, the energy that's pumping your prefrontal cortex, which is where the thinking goes on, gets taken away from there and put in other places where you can either run away if you need to or, you know, fight. So this naturally happens. So, you know, if you try to address an emotional situation in a meeting, it's really, really hard if your thinking brain's not with you. That's why, you know, it's usually best to take a break and then have someone who is objective and they're, have their thinking brain address each person separately and try to troubleshoot what's going on. So those are challenging situations, but they can definitely be addressed, particularly what we understand about social needs now and emotion management. They can definitely be addressed.
What do you mean? Can you expand on that? What do you mean what we understand about social needs?
There's been a couple of people who have done research in social needs, and the one that comes to mind right now is the Neuro Leadership Institute, and they have this model they call SCARF, which is an acronym, and it stands for the five universal social needs that we all share based on behavioral science and neuroscience. So the S stands for status, the C stands for certainty, the A stands for autonomy, the R is for relatedness, and the F is for fairness. And the way this works is if you or I perceive a decrease in one of these social needs during an interaction, then we're going to tend to feel some negative emotions and kind of withdraw. You know, we'll go into more of a threat state. But if we sense an increase in one or more of these social needs, then we're going to feel positive emotion and we're going to be drawn to the other person. So so these social needs are usually at the root of emotions in teams. And we all have different sensitivities to them, right? So I might be more sensitive to status than fairness, as an example. So the way these work is when you hit your tipping point. So my tipping point for status might be lower than yours. You know, someone could say something and you're like, whatever. And I'm like, totally offended, you know. Mm. So our tipping point could be different. But the neat thing about having five social needs to play with is what research shows is that if I hit my tipping point in one of them, if I get rewards in another one or two others, it can outweigh that tipping point and I can come back.
So let's say you're a leader, maybe an inexperienced leader, and the team hasn't gotten off to a good start because you didn't recognize. There's just so much that you lay out here that team leaders need to be aware of and prepared for and always sort of emotionally intelligent and in control at all times of their feelings and understanding everybody's needs. And it's daunting to think about all the things that might be on a leader's back. If let's say you're a leader who's inexperienced in some of those ways and like I said, it didn't get off to a good start. You realize you need to reset. Do you think as a leader, do you need to like bring everyone together and say, all right, I screwed up in some areas here. We're going to hit the reset button, you know, or do you just sort of subtly make adjustments as you go in order to try to recover the climate so that it can become a team that people, you know, feel like they want to be a part of and that's actually accomplishing things?
So I do think that's going to depend a little bit on the leader. For me personally, I like the reset button. I like the humility of saying I was wrong. I think that for me and my personality, that helps build trust to be able to say that you're wrong. And I think that fits with Dr. Amy Edmondson's work as well in teaming, the importance of situational humility, to building that trust and building that psychological safety. So for me, that's a way to go, to say, hey, I did some things wrong. I'd like to hit the reset button. I think that's a way to build that trust and that people are going to follow. I think that can be harder to do for someone that status is really important. But I think there's a way to approach that kind of situation too. So if you're a person where status is really important to you, I think a thing to remember when you realize you're wrong is to realize that that's an opportunity for you to learn and grow and in the process, increase your status over the longer term. So you might take more of that approach with your team of, you know, I've been thinking about this and I'd like to do this differently. So you don't necessarily have to say you were wrong, although that's a lost opportunity to build trust. But you could say, you know, take more of the learning and growing. I think this might be a different route to go. So I think there are different options that you can tailor to who you are as a person. But the important thing is that you're not always going to be right as a team leader. That just, we're not perfect. We're humans. We make mistakes. And be okay with it. It's okay to make mistakes. Know yourself enough to realize, you know, can you be that humble person, or, you know, do you need to look more at mistakes as a learning opportunities? And don't be afraid to be a leader. There's no better experience. Put yourself out there. This book will help you if you get stuck and you have no idea what to do. Call for a break. Pick up the book. Get some ideas. Go back at it again.
Let's suppose you are a member of that team. And let's say that the leader doesn't seem to realize that things have gone astray, or seem to have, you know, the knowledge or the desire to bring it back on track. What can you do as a team member to improve your experience and the experience of others on that team?
Yeah. So what I would do if I was a team member and the climate's just not working, and the leader is not aware that there's some things happening, I would call for a one-on-one meeting with the leader, and hopefully you know the leader well enough of how to approach this. But I would suggest that, you know, it might not be a bad idea. We've been a team for a while, just to take the temperature of how things are going. And you can even, there's a couple of different climate assessments referenced in the book or given in the book. You know, why don't we try one of these and see what's going on? And we can have a follow-up meeting afterwards. I mean, you could help them all through the whole thing.
Mm. And if they're a leader for whom status is important, and so, you know, even the suggestion that they might have missed something could cause them to feel threatened.
Yeah, so I wouldn't say that. If it was a leader whose status was control, I would play into that, right? So I would go into the meeting and I would say, you know, this is a great team. I'm so happy to be part of this team, so that you're, you know, recognizing their status. And I'm glad that you're leading this team. The results of this team are so important to me. You know, I recently did some reading about how important climate can be to team outcomes. And I think that, you know, we could, just to make sure that we do the best work we can for you. What have we got to lose? Why don't we, you know, try this and see if we can ramp up the performance even more? So you play to that.
Valerie Patrick is a facilitator and leadership trainer. She's author of When Bad Teams Happen to Good People, Your Complete Guide for Successful Teamwork. Thanks a lot for taking time today, Valerie. I appreciate it.
Oh, it was great to be here. It was really fun. Thanks, Julie.
And thank you for being with us today here on Top of Mind. Top of Mind is a production of BYU Radio. Cleon Wall, Ciara Hewlett, and Kyle Raymond produced the show. You can listen on demand by subscribing to our podcast. Just look for Top of Mind on your favorite podcast app for new episodes every weekday. We'd love to hear from you as well. You can reach out to us by email, topofmind@byu.edu, or find us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook @BYU Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. We'll talk soon.